The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, Section 1, continued. Cassette 8, Side 2.
True, it might take a year or two before your fate was resolved, but after all, the motherland was losing nothing in the process. You were out mining coal every day, and if one of your witnesses gave the wrong sort of testimony about you, or if none of your witnesses was alive, you had only yourself to blame, and you were sure to be entered in the documents as a traitor of the motherland. And the visiting military court would rubber stamp your tenor, and if, despite all their twisting things about, it appeared that you really hadn't worked for the Germans, and if, and this was the main point, you had not had the chance to see the Americans and English with your own eyes, to have been liberated from captivity by them instead of by us was a gravely aggravating circumstance, then the security officers would decide the degree of isolation in which you were to be held. Certain people were ordered to change their place of residence, which always breaks a person's ties with his environment and makes him more vulnerable. Others were valiantly offered the chance to go to work in the VOKHR, the Militarized Guard Service. In that situation, while nominally remaining free, a man lost all his personal freedom and was sent off to some isolated area. There was a third category. After a handshake, some were humanely permitted to return home, although even without aggravating circumstances, they deserved to be shot for having surrendered. But people in this category celebrated prematurely. Even before the former prisoner arrived home, his case had reached his home district through the secret channels of state security. These people remained eternally outsiders, and with the first mass arrests, like those of 1948 to 1949, they were immediately arrested for hostile propaganda or some other reason. I was imprisoned with people in that category too. Oh, if I'd only known. That was the refrain in the prison cells that spring. If I had only known that this was how I would be greeted, that they would deceive me so, that this would be my fate, would I have really returned to my motherland? Not for anything. I would have made my way to Switzerland, to France. I would have gone across the sea, across the ocean, across three oceans. In actual fact, even when POWs actually knew what would happen to them, they behaved in exactly the same way. Vasily Alexandrov was taken prisoner in Finland. He was sought out there by some elderly Petersburg merchant, who asked him his name and patronymic, and then said, "In 1917 I owed your grandfather a large debt, and I didn't have the chance to pay it. Here you are, take it." An old debt is a windfall. After the war, Alexandrov was accepted by the circle of Russian émigrés, and he got engaged to a girl there whom he came to love, and not just casually. To educate him, his future father-in-law gave him a bound set of Pravda, just as it was issued from 1918 to 1941, without any deletions or corrections. At the same time, he recounted to him more or less completely the history of the waves of arrests, as we have set it forth in Chapter 2 above. And nevertheless, Alexandrov abandoned his fiancée and his wealth, and returned to the USSR, where he was given, as one can easily guess, 10 years and disenfranchisement for 5 more. In 1953, he was happy to have managed to snag himself a job as foreman in a special camp. But the more thoughtful prisoners corrected them. They had made their mistake earlier. They were stupid to have dashed off to the front lines in 1941. It takes a fool to rush off to war. Right from the start, they should have gotten themselves set up in the rear, somewhere quiet. Those who did are heroes now, and it would have been an even surer thing just to desert. Almost certainly one's skin would be whole. They didn't get 10 years either, but 8 or 7, and they weren't excluded from any of the cushy jobs in camp. After all, a deserter was not regarded as an enemy or a traitor or a political prisoner. He was considered not a hostile factor, but a friendly one, a non-political offender, so to speak. That point of view aroused passionate argument and objections. The deserters had to spend all those years rotting in prison, and they would not be forgiven. But there would soon be an amnesty for everyone else. They would all be released. At that time, the principal advantage of being a deserter was still unknown. Those who had gotten in via 5810, snatched from their apartments or from the Red Army, often envied the rest. What the hell? For the very same money, in other words, for the same 10-year sentence, they could have seen so many interesting things, like those other fellows who had just about been everywhere. And here we are, about to croak in camp, without ever having seen anything beyond our own stinking stairs. Incidentally, those who were in on Article 5810 could hardly conceal their triumphant presentiment that they would be the first to be amnested. The only ones who did not sigh, "Oh, if I had only known," because they knew very well what they were doing, and the only ones who did not expect any mercy and did not expect an amnesty, were the Vlasov men. I had known about them and been perplexed about them long before our unexpected meeting on the board bunks of prison. First, there had been the leaflets, repeatedly soaked through, dried out, and lost in the high grass, uncut for the third year, of the front-line strip near Orel. In December 1942, they had announced the creation in Smolensk of a Russian committee, which apparently claimed to be some sort of Russian government, and yet at the same time seemed not to be one. Evidently the Germans themselves had not yet made up their minds. For that reason, the communique seemed to be a hoax. There was a photograph of General Vlasov in the leaflets, and his biography was outlined. In the fuzzy photograph, his face looked well-fed and successful, like all our generals of the new stripe. They told me later that this wasn't so, that Vlasov's face was more like that of a Western general, high, thin, with horn-rimmed glasses. His biography testified to a penchant for success. He had begun in a peasant family, and 1937 had not broken his skyrocketing career. Nor was it ruined by his service as a military advisor to Chiang Kai-shek. The first and only disaster of his earlier life had occurred when his second shock army, after being encircled, was ineptly abandoned to die of starvation. But how much of that whole biography could be believed? As far as one can establish at this late date, Andrei Andreevich Vlasov, prevented by the revolution from completing his studies at the Nizhny Novgorod Orthodox Seminary, was drafted into the Red Army in 1919 and fought as an enlisted man. On the southern front, against Denikin and Rangel, he rose to be commander of a platoon, then of a company. In the 20s, he completed the Vistrel courses. He became a member of the Communist Party in 1930. In 1936, having attained the rank of regimental commander, he was sent to China as a military advisor. Evidently, he had no ties to the top military and party circles, and he therefore turned up naturally in that Stalinist second echelon of officers promoted to replace the purged commanders of armies, divisions, and brigades. From 1938 on, he commanded a division. And in 1940, when new, in other words old, officer ranks were created, he became a major general. From additional information, one can conclude that in that corps of newly made generals, many of whom were totally stupid and inexperienced, Vlasov was one of the most talented. His 99th Infantry Division, which he had instructed and trained from the summer of 1940 on, was not caught off balance by the German attack. On the contrary, while the rest of the army reeled backward, his division advanced, retook Przemysl, and held it for 6 days. Quickly skipping the rank of corps commander, in 1941 Lieutenant General Vlasov was in command of the 37th Army near Kiev. He made his way out of the enormous Kiev encirclement, and in December 1941, near Moscow, he commanded the 20th Army, whose successful Soviet counteroffensive for defense of the capital, the taking of Solnechnogorsk, was noted in the Sovinformbüro communique for December the 12th. And the list of generals mentioned there was as follows: Zhukov, Lelyushenko, Kuznetsov, Vlasov, Rokossovsky, Govorov. Thanks to the speed with which officers were promoted in those months, he became deputy commander of the Volkov Front under Meretskov and took over command of the Second Shock Army. On January the 7th, 1942, at the head of that army, He began a drive to break the Leningrad blockade, an attack across the Volkhov River to the northwest. This had been planned as a combined operation, a concerted push from several directions and from Leningrad itself. At scheduled intervals, the 54th, the 4th, and the 52nd armies were to take part in it also. But those three armies either did not advance because they were unready, or else came to a quick halt. At that time, we still didn't have the capacity to plan such complex combined operations, and more importantly, provide supplies for them. Vlasov's second shock army, however, was successful in its assault, and by February 1942 it was 46 miles deep inside the German lines. And from then on, the reckless Stalinist Supreme Command could find neither men nor ammunition to reinforce even those troops. That's the kind of reserves they had begun the offensive with. Leningrad, too, was left to die behind the blockade, having received no specific information from Novgorod. During March, the winter roads still held up. From April on, however, the entire swampy area through which the Second Army had advanced melted into mud, and there were no supply roads, and there was no help from the air. The army was without food, and at the same time Vlasov was refused permission to retreat. For 2 months they endured starvation and extermination. In the Butyrki, soldiers from that army told me how they had cut off the hoofs of dead and rotting horses and boiled the scrapings and eaten them. Then, on May the 14th, a German attack was launched from all sides against the encircled army. The only planes in the air, of course, were German. And only then, in mockery, were they given permission to pull back behind the Volkhov. They made several hopeless attempts to break through until the beginning of July. And so it was that Vlasov's second shock army perished, literally recapitulating the fate of Samsonov's Russian Second Army in World War I, having been just as insanely thrown into encirclement. Now this, of course, was treason to the motherland. This, of course, was vicious, self-obsessed betrayal. But it was Stalin's. Treason does not necessarily involve selling out for money. It can include ignorance and carelessness in the preparations for war, confusion and cowardice at its very start, the meaningless sacrifice of armies and corps solely for the sake of saving one's own marshal's uniform. Indeed, what more bitter treason is there on the part of a supreme commander-in-chief? Unlike Samsonov, Vlasov did not commit suicide. After his army had been wiped out, he wandered among the woods and swamps, and on July the 6th personally surrendered in the area of Siverskaya. He was taken to the German headquarters near Lützen in East Prussia, where they were holding several captured generals and a brigade political commissar, G.N. Zhilenkov, formerly a successful party official, and secretary of one of the Moscow District Party committees. These captives had already confessed their disagreement with the policy of the Stalin government, but they had no real leader. Vlasov became it. From his photograph, it was impossible to believe that he was an outstanding man or that for long years he had suffered profoundly for Russia. As for the leaflets reporting the creation of the ROA, the Russian Liberation Army, not only were they written in bad Russian, but they were imbued with an alien spirit that was clearly German and, moreover, seemed little concerned with their presumed subject. Besides, and on the other hand, they contained crude boasting about the plentiful chow available and the cheery mood of the soldiers. Somehow, one couldn't believe in that army, and if it really did exist, what kind of cheery mood could it be in? Only a German could lie like that. In reality, there was no Russian Liberation Army until almost the very end of the war. Both the name and the insignia devised for it were invented by a German of Russian origin, Captain Strickfeldt, in the Ostpropaganda Abteilung. Although he held only a minor position, he had influence, and he tried to convince the Hitlerite leadership that a German-Russian alliance was essential, and that the Russians should be encouraged to collaborate with Germany. A vain undertaking for both sides. Each side wanted only to use and deceive the other. But in the given situation, the Germans had power. They were on top of the setup, and the Vlasov officers had only their fantasy, at the bottom of the abyss. There was no such army, but anti-Soviet formations made up of Soviet citizens were organized from the very start of the war. The first to support the Germans were the Lithuanians. In the 1 year we had been there, we had aroused their deep, angry hostility. And then the SS Galicia division was created from Ukrainian volunteers, and Estonian units afterward. In the fall of 1941, guard companies appeared in Byelorussia and a Tatar battalion in the Crimea. We ourselves had sowed the seeds of all this. Take, for example, our stupid 20-year policy of closing and destroying the Muslim mosques in the Crimea, and compare that with the policy of the far-sighted conqueror Catherine the Great, who contributed state funds for building and expanding the Crimean mosques. And the Hitlerites, when they arrived, were smart enough to present themselves as their defenders. Later, Caucasian detachments and Cossack armies, more than a cavalry corps, put in an appearance on the German side. In the first winter of the war, platoons and companies of Russian volunteers began to be formed. But the German command was very distrustful of these Russian units, and their master sergeants and lieutenants were Germans. Only their non-coms below master sergeant were Russian. They also used such German commands as Achtung, Halt, etc. More significant and entirely Russian were the following units: a brigade in Lokot in Bryansk province from November 1941, when a local teacher of engineering, K.P. Voskobojnikov, proclaimed the National Labour Party of Russia and issued a manifesto to the citizens of the nation hoisting the flag of St. George. A unit in the Ozentorf settlement near Orsha, formed at the beginning of 1942 under the leadership of Russian émigrés — it must be said that only a small group of Russian émigrés joined this movement, and even they did not conceal their anti-German feelings, and allowed many crossovers, including a whole battalion, to the Soviet side, after which they were dropped by the Germans — and a unit formed by Gil in the summer of 1942 near Lublin. V.V. Gil, a Communist Party member, and even, it seems, a Jew, not only survived as a POW, but with the help of other POWs became the head of a camp near Suwalki and offered to create a fighting alliance of Russian nationalists for the Germans. However, there was as yet no Russian Liberation Army in all of this, and no Vlasov. The companies under German command were put on the Russian front as an experiment, and the Russian units were sent against the Bryansk, Orsha, and Polish partisans. We soon discovered that there really were Russians fighting against us, and that they fought harder than any SS men. In July 1943, for example, near Orel, a platoon of Russians in German uniform defended Sobakinskaya Veselki. They fought with the desperation that might have been expected if they had built the place themselves. One of them was driven into a root cellar. They threw hand grenades in after him, and he fell silent. But they had no more than stuck their heads in than he let them have another volley from his automatic pistol. Only when they lobbed in an anti-tank grenade did they find out that, within the root cellar, he had another foxhole in which he had taken shelter from the infantry grenades. Just try to imagine the degree of shock, deafness, and hopelessness in which he had kept on fighting. They defended, for example, the unshakable Dnieper bridgehead south of Tursk. For 2 weeks we continued to fight there for a mere few hundred yards. The battles were fierce in December 1943, and so was the cold. Through many long days, both we and they went through the extreme trials of winter, fighting in winter camouflage cloaks that covered our overcoats and caps. Near Malye Kozlovichi, I was told, an interesting encounter took place. As the soldiers dashed back and forth among the pines, things got confused, and two soldiers lay down next to one another. No longer very accurately oriented, they both kept shooting at someone somewhere over there. Both had Soviet automatic pistols. They shared their cartridges, praised one another, and together swore at the grease freezing on their automatic pistols. Finally, their pistols stopped firing altogether, and they decided to take a break and light up. They pulled back their white hoods, and at the same instant each saw the other's cap, the eagle and the star. They jumped up. their automatic pistols still refused to fire. Grabbing them by the barrel and swinging them like clubs, they began to go at each other. This, if you will, was not politics, and not the motherland, but just sheer caveman distrust. If I take pity on him, he is going to kill me. In East Prussia, a trio of captured Vlasov men was being marched along the roadside a few steps away from me. At that moment, a T-34 tank thundered down the highway. Suddenly, one of the captives twisted around and dived underneath the tank. The tank veered, but the edge of its track crushed him nevertheless. The broken man lay writhing, bloody foam coming from his mouth. And one could certainly understand him. He preferred a soldier's death to being hanged in a dungeon. They had no choice. There was no other way for them to fight. They had no chance to find a way out to safeguard their lives by some more cautious mode of fighting. If pure surrender was considered unforgivable treason to the motherland, then what about those who had taken up enemy arms? Our propaganda, in all its crudity, explained their conduct as, one, treason, was it biologically based, carried in the bloodstream, or two, cowardice, which it certainly was not. A coward tries to find a spot where things are easy, soft, safe. And men could be induced to enter the Wehrmacht's Vlasov detachments only in the last extremity, only at the limit of desperation, only out of inexhaustible hatred of the Soviet regime, only with total contempt for their own safety. For they knew they would never have the faintest glimpse of mercy. When we captured them, we shot them, as soon as the first intelligible Russian word came from their mouths. In Russian captivity, as in German captivity, the worst lot of all was reserved for the Russians. In general, this war revealed to us that the worst thing in the world was to be a Russian. I recall with shame an incident I observed during the liquidation, in other words, the plundering, of the Bobruisk encirclement. When I was walking along the highway among wrecked and overturned German automobiles, and a wealth of booty lay scattered everywhere. German cart horses wandered aimlessly in and out of a shallow depression, where wagons and automobiles that had gotten stuck were buried in the mud, and bonfires of booty were smoking away. Then I heard a cry for help. "Mr. Captain! Mr. Captain!" A prisoner, on foot in German breeches, was crying out to me in pure Russian. He was naked from the waist up, and his face, chest, shoulders, and back were all bloody, while a sergeant Osobist, a security man, seated on a horse, drove him forward with a whip, pushing him with his horse. He kept lashing that naked back up and down with the whip, without letting him turn around, without letting him ask for help. He drove him along, beating and beating him, raising new crimson welts on his skin. And this was not one of the Punic Wars, nor a war between the Greeks and the Persians. Any officer possessing any authority in any army on earth ought to have stopped that senseless torture. In any army on earth, yes, but in ours? Given our fierce and uncompromising method of dividing mankind, if you are not with us, if you are not our own, etc., then you deserve nothing but contempt and annihilation. So I was afraid to defend the Vlasov men against the Osobist. I said nothing, and I did nothing. I passed him by as if I could not hear him, so that I myself would not be infected by that universally recognized plague. What if the Vlasov man was indeed some kind of supervillain? Or maybe the Osobist would think something was wrong with me, and then... Or, putting it more simply, for anyone who knows anything about the situation in the Soviet army at that time, would that Osobist have paid any attention to an army captain? So the Osobist continued to lash the defenseless man brutally and drive him along like a beast. This picture will remain etched in my mind forever. This, after all, is almost a symbol of the archipelago. It ought to be on the jacket of this book. The Vlasov men had a presentiment of all this. They knew it, ahead of time. Nevertheless, on the left sleeve of their German uniforms, they sewed the shield with the white, blue, red edging, the field of St. Andrew, and the letters ROA. These letters became even better known, although, as before, there was still no real Russian Liberation Army. The units were all scattered and kept subordinate to German orders, and the Vlasov generals had nothing to do but play cards in Dahlemdorf, near Berlin. By the middle of 1942, Vosko Bonyakov's brigade, which after his death was commanded by Kaminsky, numbered 5 infantry regiments of 2,500 to 3,000 men each, with attached artillery crews, a tank battalion consisting of 2 dozen Soviet tanks, and an artillery battalion with 3 dozen guns. The commanding officers were POW officers, and the rank and file was made up, in considerable part, of local Bryansk volunteers. This brigade was under orders to guard the area against partisans. In the summer of 1942, the brigade of Gil Blazewicz was transferred for the same purpose from Poland, where it had been notable for its cruelty toward Poles and Jews, to the area near Mogilev. At the beginning of 1943, its command refused to acknowledge Vlasov's authority, demanding that he explain why, in his stated program, there was no reference to the struggle against world Jewry and Jew-loving commissars. These were the very men, called the Rodionovites, because Gil had changed his name to Rodionov, who in August 1943, when Hitler's approaching defeat became apparent, changed their black flag with a silver skull to a red flag and proclaimed Soviet authority and a large partisan region in the northeast corner of Byelorussia. At that time, Soviet newspapers began to write about the partisan region, but without explaining its origins. Later on, all surviving Rodionovites were imprisoned. And whom did the Germans immediately throw in against the Rodionovites? The Kaminsky Brigade. That was in May 1944, and they also threw in 13 of their own divisions in an effort to liquidate the partisan region. That was the extent to which Germans understood all those tricolour cockades, St. George and the Field of St. Andrew. The Russian and German languages were mutually untranslatable, inexpressible, uncorrelatable. Still worse, in October 1944, the Germans threw in Kaminsky's brigade, with its Muslim units, to suppress the Warsaw uprising. While one group of Russians sat traitorously dozing beyond the Vistula, watching the death of Warsaw through their binoculars, other Russians crushed the uprising. Hadn't the Poles had enough Russian villainy to bear in the 19th century without having to endure more of it in the 20th? For that matter, was that the last of it? Perhaps more is still to come. The career of the Ossintorf Battalion was apparently more straightforward. This consisted of about 600 soldiers and 200 officers, with an émigré command, I.K. Sakharov and Lambsdorff, Russian uniforms, and a white-blue-red flag. It was thrown in near Pskov. Then, reinforced to regimental strength, it was readied for a parachute drop on the line of Vologda Archangel, the idea being to make use of the nest of concentration camps in that area. Throughout 1943, Igor Sakharov managed to prevent his unit from being sent against the partisans. But then he was replaced, and the battalion was first disarmed and imprisoned in a camp, and then sent off to the Western Front. Then, in the fall of 1943, the Germans decided to send the Russian cannon fodder to the Atlantic Wall and against the French and Italian resistance, having lost, forgotten, and not even tried to recall its original purpose. Those among the Vlasov men who had managed to retain some kind of political rationality or hope, thereupon lost both. The inhabitants of the occupied areas held them in contempt as German hirelings. So did the Germans, because of their Russian blood. Their pitiful little newspapers were worked over with a German censor's broadsword. Greater Germany and the Führer. And the Vlasov men had one way out of all that, to fight to the death, and when they were not fighting, to down vodka and more vodka. Foredoomed. That was their existence during all their years of war and alien lands, and there was no salvation for them from any direction. Hitler and those around him, even when they were retreating on every front and were staring their own destruction in the face, could still not overcome their intense distrust of wholly separate Russian units. They could not bring themselves to organize divisions that were entirely Russian, to allow even the shadow of a Russia that was not totally subject to them. Only in the crack of the final debacle in November 1944 was a belated theatrical production at last permitted in Prague. The creation of a Committee for the Liberation of the Peoples of Russia, combining all the different national groups, and a manifesto, which, like everything that had preceded it, was neither fish nor fowl, since the concept of a Russia independent of Germany and Nazism was still not tolerated. Vlasov became chairman of the committee, and only in the fall of 1944 did they begin to form Vlasov divisions that were exclusively Russian. They were the first, based on the Kaminsky Brigade under S.K. Bunyachenko, the second under Zverev, former military commandant of Kharkov, half the third, segments of the fourth, and Maltsev's Air Force detachment. Only four divisions were authorized. Probably the wise German political leaders had concluded that at this point the Russian workers in Germany, the Ostovtsi, would rush to take up arms. But the Red Army was already on the Vistula and the Danube, and ironically, as though to confirm the far-sightedness of the very near-sighted Germans, those Vlasov divisions, in their first and last independent action, dealt a blow to the Germans themselves. In the general disaster, Vlasov gathered up his 2.5 divisions near Prague at the end of April, without coordinating his action with the German Supreme Command. It became known at this point that SS General Steiner was preparing to destroy the Czech capital rather than surrender it intact, and Vlasov ordered his divisions to the aid of the Czech rebels. And at that point, all the hurt, bitterness, and anger against the Germans that had accumulated during 3 cruel and futile years in the breasts of the enslaved Russians was vented in the attack on the Germans. They were shoved out of Prague from an unexpected direction. Did all Czechs realize later which Russians had saved their city? Our own history is similarly distorted. We claim that Prague was saved by Soviet armies, although they couldn't have gotten there in time. Then the Vlasov army began to retreat toward Bavaria and the Americans. They were pinning all their hopes on the possibility of being useful to the Allies. In this way, their years of dangling in the German noose would finally become meaningful. But the Americans greeted them with a wall of armor and forced them to surrender to Soviet hands, as stipulated by the Yalta Conference. In Austria that May, Churchill perpetrated the same sort of act of a loyal ally, but out of our accustomed modesty, we did not publicize it. He turned over to the Soviet command the Cossack Corps of 90,000 men. This surrender was an act of double dealing consistent with the spirit of traditional English diplomacy. The heart of the matter was that the Cossacks were determined to fight to the death, or to cross the ocean all the way to Paraguay or Indochina if they had to. Anything rather than surrender alive. Therefore, the English proposed, first, that the Cossacks give up their arms on the pretext of replacing them with standardized weapons. Then the officers, without the enlisted men, were summoned to a supposed conference on the future of the army in the city of Judenburg, in the English occupation zone. But the English had secretly turned the city over to the Soviet armies the night before. 40 busloads of officers, all the way from commanders of companies, on up to General Krasnov himself, crossed a high viaduct and drove straight down into a semicircle of black mariahs, next to which stood convoy guards with lists in their hands. The road back was blocked by Soviet tanks. The officers didn't even have anything with which to shoot themselves or to stab themselves to death, since their weapons had been taken away. They jumped from the viaduct onto the paving stones below. Immediately afterward, and just as treacherously, the English turned over the rank and file soldiers by the trainload, pretending that they were on their way to receive new weapons from their commanders. In their own countries, Roosevelt and Churchill are honored as embodiments of statesmanlike wisdom. To us, in our Russian prison conversations, their consistent short-sightedness and stupidity stood out as astonishingly obvious. How could they, in their decline from 1941 to 1945, fail to secure any guarantees whatever of the independence of Eastern Europe? How could they give away broad regions of Saxony and Thuringia in exchange for the preposterous toy of a four-zone Berlin, their own future Achilles' heel? And what was the military or political sense in their surrendering to destruction at Stalin's hands, hundreds of thousands of armed Soviet citizens determined not to surrender? They say it was the price they paid for Stalin's agreeing to enter the war against Japan. With the atom bomb already in their hands, they paid Stalin for not refusing to occupy Manchuria, for strengthening Mao Tse-tung in China, and for giving Kim Il-sung control of half Korea. What bankruptcy of political thought! And when, subsequently, the Russians pushed out Mikolajczyk, when Benes and Masaryk came to their ends, when Berlin was blockaded, and Budapest flamed and fell silent, and Korea went up in smoke, and Britain's conservatives fled from Suez, could one really believe that those among them with the most accurate memories did not at least recall that episode of the Cossacks? Along with them, he also handed over many wagon loads of old people, women and children, who did not want to return to their native Cossack rivers. This great hero, monuments to whom will in time cover all England, ordered that they, too, be surrendered to their deaths. In addition to the hurriedly created Vlasov divisions, quite a few Russian subunits went right on turning sour in the depths of the German army, wearing standard German uniforms. They finished out the war on various sectors and in different ways. I myself fell under Vlasov fire a few days before my arrest. There were Russians in the East Prussian sack, which we had surrounded, and one night at the end of January, their unit tried to break through our position to the west, without artillery preparation, in silence. There was no firmly delineated front in any case, and they penetrated us in depth, catching my sound locator battery, which was out in front, in a pincers. I just barely managed to pull it back by the last remaining road. But then I went back for a piece of damaged equipment, and before dawn I watched as they suddenly rose from the snow where they dug in, wearing their winter camouflage cloaks, hurled themselves with a cheer on the battery of a 152mm gun battalion at Adlik-Schwenkitten, and knocked out 12 heavy cannon with hand grenades before they could fire a shot. Pursued by their tracer bullets, our last little group ran almost 2 miles in fresh snow to the bridge across the Pasarga River. And there they were stopped. Soon after that, I was arrested. And now, on the eve of the victory parade, here we all were, sitting together on the board bunks of the Butyrki. I took puffs from their cigarettes, and they took puffs from mine. And paired with one or another of them, I used to carry out the 6-bucket tin latrine barrel. Many of the Vlasov men, like the spies for hire, were young, born, say, between 1915 and 1922, that same young and unknown tribe which hustling, bustling Lunacharsky had hurried to greet in the name of Pushkin. Most of them got into Vlasov military units through that same blind chance which led their comrades in a neighbouring camp to get into the spy thing. It all depended on which recruiter had gone where. The recruiters had explained to them jeeringly, or rather it would have been jeering if it hadn't been the truth, "Stalin has renounced you. Stalin doesn't give a damn about you." Soviet law had outlawed them even before they outlawed themselves. So they signed up, some of them simply to get out of a death camp, others with the hope of going over to the partisans. And some of them did, and fought side by side with the partisans. But according to Stalin's rules, that didn't soften their sentences in the least. However, in the case of some, the shame of 1941, that stunning defeat after long, long years of braggadocio, ate at their hearts. Some believed that the primary guilt for those inhuman POW camps belonged to Stalin. They, too, wanted the chance to speak out about themselves and their awful experience, to affirm that they, too, were particles of Russia, and wanted to influence Russia's future, and not to be the puppets of other people's mistakes. But fate played them an even bitterer trick, and they became more abject pawns than before. The Germans, in their shallow stupidity and self-importance, allowed them only to die for the German Reich, but denied them the right to plan an independent destiny for Russia. And the Allies were 2,000 versts away, and anyway, what kind of allies would they indeed turn out to be? The term Vlasovite in our country has the same force as the word sewage. We feel we are dirtying our mouths merely by pronouncing it, and therefore no one dares utter a sentence with Blasovite as its subject. But that is no way to write history. Now, a quarter of a century later, when most of them have perished in camps and those who have survived are living out their lives in the far north, I would like to issue a reminder, through these pages, that this was a phenomenon totally unheard of in all world history. That several hundred thousand young men, aged 20 to 30, took up arms against their fatherland as allies of its most evil enemy. This, in fact, is the number of Soviet citizens who were in the Wehrmacht, in pre-Vlasov and Vlasov formations, and in the Cossack, Muslim, Baltic, and Ukrainian units and detachments. Perhaps there is something to ponder here. Who was more to blame, those youths or the grey fatherland? One cannot explain this treason biologically. It has to have had a social cause. Because, as the old proverb says, well-fed horses don't rampage. Then picture to yourself a field in which starved, neglected, crazed horses are rampaging back and forth. That same spring, many Russian émigrés were also in those cells. It was very like a dream, the resurrection of buried history. The weighty tomes on the Civil War had long since been completed, and their covers shut tight. The causes for which people fought in it had been decided. The chronology of its events had been set down in textbooks. The leaders of the white movement were, it appeared, no longer our contemporaries on earth, but mere ghosts of a past that had melted away. The Russian émigrés had been more cruelly dispersed than the tribes of Israel. And, in our Soviet imagination, if they were still dragging out their lives somewhere, it was as pianists in stinking little restaurants, as lackeys, laundresses, beggars, morphine and cocaine addicts, and virtual corpses. Right up to 1941, when the war came, it would have been impossible to find out from any hints in our newspapers, our lofty literature, our criticism of the arts, nor did our own well-fed masters of art and literature help us find out, that Russia abroad was a great spiritual world, that in it Russian philosophy was living and developing, that out there were philosophers like Bulgakov, Berdyaev, and Lossky, that Russian art had enchanted the world, that Rachmaninoff, Shalyapin, Benoit, Diaghilev, Pavlova, and the Don Cossack chorus of Yarov were out there, that profound studies of Dostoevsky were being undertaken, at a time when he was anathema in the Soviet Union. That the incredible writer Nabokov Sirin also existed out there. That Bunin himself was still alive and had been writing for all these 20 years. That journals of the arts were being published. That theatrical works were being produced. The Russians from the same areas of Russia came together in groups where their mother tongue could be heard. And that émigré men had not given up marrying émigré women, who in turn presented them with children, which meant young people our own age. The picture of emigration presented in our country was so falsified that if one had conducted a mass survey to ask which side the Russian emigres were on in the Spanish Civil War, or else perhaps what side they were on in the Second World War, with one voice everyone would have replied, for Franco, for Hitler. Even now, people in our country do not know that many more white emigres fought on the Republican side in Spain. That both the Vlasov divisions and the Cossack Corps von Panwitz, the Krasnov Corps, were made up of Soviet citizens and not of émigrés. The émigrés did not support Hitler. They ostracized Merezhovsky and Gippius, who took Hitler's part, leaving them to alienated loneliness. There was a joke, except it wasn't a joke, to the effect that Denikin wanted to fight for the Soviet Union against Hitler, and that at one time Stalin planned to arrange his return to the motherland, not for military reasons, obviously, but as a symbol of national unity. This book is continued on Cassette 9, Side 1.